Welcome to Murky Chronicles, episode 35. Our guest today is world-renowned Bigfoot researcher Todd Neese. I am Thaifullah, the Butcher Dobashi.
And I am gorgeous Kenny Roberts.
And yes, you are. And I am excited for today's show, brother.
Yeah, so am I. Cannot wait to get the ball rolling and ask this guy some questions.
You know, who would have thought two professional wrestlers like us would take this show as far as we have and getting a guest like we have on today?
I don't know. We're pretty lucky. I think we're doing the right thing, brother.
That's it. You want to just go ahead and get our shout-outs out of the way and get our guest on?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
All right. I just want to shout-out to Lyrical Spit. If it wasn't for Lyrical Spit, there would be no Murky Chronicles.
Well, thank you.
Shout-out to... Yep. And then a shout-out to Micah over at Savage Reviews for all your reviews on foods and the goods and services here in the Treasure Valley and wherever he travels. Check him out on Google, Savage Reviews, and then Vince over at Emerald Street Kennels. I want to thank you for putting out a good service, and he watches our little mutt occasionally, and he's a good guy. So so that's it for me.
All right, well,
what you got?
Of course, I got to give a shout-out to the best tagline in the business, Sweet and Low Upholstery. They're stitching is bitching. And
thank you.
And I'm the new producer of Tales from the Abyss on all major podcast platforms with Jay Linderman and Pahu Rojo, a great show and a big supporter of this show, and my Lyrical Spit podcast. And you can get Lyrical Spit and Murky Chronicles on all major podcast platforms and on lyricalspit.com for links too. And don't forget about our 24-hour hotline, 360-200-8779. Leave a message, and you may just hear yourself on the show. And I think that's all the stuff I got to pimp out.
Awesome.
Anything else?
What? Nope, that's it. Let's get to it.
All right, bro. Well, you know what? We'll be right back with Todd Neese right after this brief commercial break. See you on the other side. I would like to introduce to Murky Chronicles, he's world-renowned Bigfoot researcher, and he's been doing it for many years, and he's a veteran of the U.S. military. I want to thank him for that. The one and only Todd Neese. Welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Yes, welcome.
Really impressed with your bio and stuff, and it said that you had a Bigfoot encounter and turned researcher. How'd that come along?
Well, to start off with, I think it's important to note that I live in the Pacific Northwest, specifically Oregon. And living here, you can't help but hear stories about Bigfoot or Sasquatch or whatever you want to call them. But and I was no exception, but personally, I had no belief in their existence and just had relegated it to a spooky campfire story. So that all changed for me on April 3rd, 1993, when I was conducting explosives training with the 1249th Combat Engineers of the Oregon Army National Guard. And on that particular day, we had access to three gravel quarries on some very private timberland. And for what your listeners might not know is that combat engineers use explosives, everything from C4 to ammonium nitrate, dynamite, TNT. We install landmines, we take them out. So explosives are a big part of what we do. And so that particular day, what we were doing was practicing our trade. So again, we had three sites to do that day. It was a Saturday and actually a pretty nice day in April for the Coast Range, being a temperate rainforest. It was a sunny, beautiful day, and we had conducted two blasts And we're just getting to the third one, which was a cratering charge, where we used about 250 pounds of ammonium nitrate to simulate blowing a road in half so the enemy couldn't use it. So anyway, we had got the explosive in the ground and set our fuses for about 11 minutes. And once we ignited them, obviously our SOP is to get the heck out of there. So we had four vehicles, two Humvees up front, 2.5 ton or deuce and a half transport behind that. And then in the rear, the captain followed up in his own Humvee. I was a passenger in the second Humvee, and I was sitting right behind the driver. And as we're heading to this safety area to await the explosion, I was doing what I normally do out there, because I was I did a lot of hunting in that area for elk and deer. And so I had the window down, and I was just glancing about the countryside while we headed down, or our convoy headed down. And we came around this corner, and at that point, the second rock quarry, gravel quarry, actually, but it came into view, and I'm looking down that direction, and I see these three figures standing together side by side facing our convoy. And my first thought was, what the heck are those people doing down there? Because it technically they were in close enough range to feel the effects of the blast that was about to go off. But I hardly got that thought through my mind when I realized what I was looking at were not people at all. In fact, just their size, their coloring, their profiles were way outside of human norms. Specifically, the arms, where our arms, if we drop them to the side, they pretty much come down to our waist. These arms went all the way down to their knees on all three of them. They were not wearing any clothing. They were, which I could have made out, they were pretty much jet black from head to toe. And huge. The one in the center was, I estimated, about 9 feet tall. The two that flanked it to its left and right, I would estimate about 7 to 7.5 feet tall, but huge just the same. And all of them were built like, I mean, weightlifters. They were just massive. But it was the activity that they presented also that pretty much sealed it for me, because while that one in the middle stood there just like a statue, the two on either side of it were swinging their arms left to right, like they're shifting weight from one foot to the other and rocking side to side. And they did this the entire time I saw them, and not talking 5 or 10 second view. This was about 25 seconds that I watched this activity before I lost sight of them.
Were they just watching?
And I have to tell you,
were they just watching?
They were obviously watching our convoy. So after about 25 seconds of watching this activity, we rounded the corner. I lost sight of them and just really just tried to take it in as what I just saw. I mean, I can't unsee it, you know, and it's as clear today as it was back then. These three creatures were definitely not human. And so as we rounded the corner, we weren't too far from the safety area. So when we did get to that point, I just instinctively jumped out of the Humvee and started jogging back up in the direction we came, hoping that I would be able to get another view of them. Unfortunately, based on our protocol, nobody was allowed to be out of sight of everybody. We had to have 100% integrity, just because of the danger of what we're doing. I went as far as I dared, and I got my hand up to my head. I'm standing on my tiptoes. I'm trying to see over this little berm that was between me and the quarry, and I could not. I didn't go any further. I didn't dare, but at that point, I heard somebody call out my name, And I look to my right, and here comes Sergeant Martin. Been working with him all day, and he said, "Hey, what are you looking at?" And I said, "Nothing." And he continued to come my way. I remember he was smoking on a cigarette, and he came up and looked me straight in the eyes and goes, "I don't suppose you saw what I saw down at the second blast site." And of course, he said, "I don't know, Jeff.
Oh, wow. What did you see?"
And he told me he saw the exact same thing, the same number, same description. He said, "I saw three huge hair cover, I don't know, Bigfoot, I guess." And at that, of course, I acknowledged I had seen him too. And, you know, it was nice to have that corroboration, but even if I hadn't, it wouldn't change anything. But just to fast forward, the very next month when we got together to train, it just so happened that two more soldiers came forward and also admitted seeing the same thing that Jeff and I had seen. So it's an unusual encounter in that obviously the activity we were involved in, you know, we're blowing up the woods. We're not talking small explosions either. And multiple sightings, multiple creature sightings are fairly rare. And then to have multiple eyewitnesses, makes it rather unique. And I've been searching ever since.
Well, that's awesome. Have you been back to that spot since? Did it do any further, you know,
I have.
Expeditions, have you? Okay.
That's awesome. Many times. Now, bear in mind that this area that we were training in is closed off to the public.
Oh, okay.
And it's heavily patrolled by security. We had to have special permission by the timber company to go in there and do what we did that day. However, as time went on, I got to meet some pretty important players in the Bigfoot scene, notably Peter Byrne, who's a pioneer researcher, and he's 96 to this day, and he's still plugging along. But Peter's been searching for Bigfoot going back to the early 60s. He met up with me, and I was surprised that somehow he had obtained the master key to all the gates up there. And after a couple trips, checking out the area, he was satisfied with what he had seen. He ended up handing me those keys. So, I mean, for the next 2 years, I had complete access to all the gates, which is amazing because that very, very few people get that access, you know. And so I would go up to this site, again, being a traditional National Guardsman at that time, we're drilling one week in a month, generally. And so after the final formation of the day, we were allowed to, we had an open post. We were allowed to, get lodging wherever we wanted to, as long as we reported it the next morning. And so I'd go up to this little fish market in Seaside, the nearest town, and I would buy what they would call crab bait, really. It's all the waste material from salmon or steelhead. So it would be the heads and the skin and the bones and that kind of stuff, the fins. And it was cheap. I'd get a big bag of it for a couple bucks, and I would take it up there, unlock the gates, lock them behind me, go to the next one, unlock it, lock it behind me, knowing that I am the only person up there. And it took me a while to get the nerve to go up there by myself, but I did, and it got a little easier as time went on. And what I would do is I would hang this crab bait, if you will, in a clear bag, using 550 cord, and hang it high enough off the ground that nothing else could possibly reach it. And so I'd tie this up in a tree and just let it hang there. And then every month I'd go back and check, and sure enough, every month the bag was gone. I did this for 9 months in a row. And, of course, looking around for tracks as well and other evidence. But what was interesting was the part of the bag where I tied the 550 cord around would still be caught in that knot. The rest of the bag was pulled, ripped away from the cord, and carried off somewhere. And every time I searched for the bag itself, at least, and I never could find it. And you would think if a bear, birds, if they would have got to it, that bag would be just laying there,
yep,
somewhere in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever tick had plucked it like a apple off a tree and just walked off with it, consumed it somewhere else. Now, so yeah, to answer your question, I did go back there many, many times, and actually set up my very first expedition in that rock quarry.
That was in Oregon, right?
Where they were standing. Correct. This would be in Clatsop County, the very northwest corner of the state, maybe about 10 miles off inland from the Pacific.
Now,
yeah, I'm pretty familiar with that area, but I've vacationed a lot, Seaside, Astoria area. Okay, yeah, there's a lot of woods there.
We were due east of Seaside, but basically between Seaside and Saddle Mountain, if you know where that's at.
Yep.
Now, I was reading.
Yeah, I've taken that route.
I was reading through your resume, and it was very impressive. Now, did you ever imagine you'd be traveling and talking Bigfoot, you know, after your first experience? And
well, not, no. You know, to start with, I was an eyewitness. Okay. I didn't consider myself a researcher at that time. And I was somewhat concerned about my reputation in that my day job, when I wasn't at drill, I was a vice president of a shipping company here in Portland. On top of that, a family man raising three young boys and a non-commissioned officer in the military. And I really had to weigh the consequences of going public about it. You know, on one hand, you know, I'm really putting my hard-earned reputation on the line. I figured I better expect a lot of doubters and people doubting my integrity or my sanity or what have you. And of course, those that knew me better. But to go out publicly and talk about it, I was really, really reluctant. The first time I actually did come out publicly, I was asked to be on the set of Unsolved Mysteries. I was doing a special on Bigfoot. This was in 1994, so about a year later. And so that's the first time I became public on camera. Again, most of the interest was my sighting and not so much the research. In 1996, I was invited to speak for the first time publicly in Harrison Hot Springs, British Columbia. And that just kind of set things in motion. They asked me back 4 years in a row. And, it just kind of snowballed from there. And, but, you know, being active duty, my last 14 and a half years in the Army was active duty. I just did not have the time to vote that I really wanted to. And since retiring in 2019, I think you'll see in my resume, there's been a big uptick in public appearances and podcasts such as yours. I enjoy talking about it. I've got a lot of different theories about these things, and I've had other experiences, other encounters, if you will, since 1993. Some pretty amazing stuff, and I think it's important that we know as much as we can about these things. They're incredibly elusive, but part of that might have to do with the scarcity of their population, and that concerns me.
What are
I've
your
come to the point where I believe these?
What are your concerns?
Well, I think it's fair to say we're dealing with a relatively small population of these things, and by a small population, you know, could be anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000, and that might sound like a lot, but when you spread that out over the territory, that, just in the Pacific Northwest, 2,000 of anything is a drop in the bucket. And, so I have concerns about the possibility that, we just out of ignorance may end up watching these things, work closer and closer to extinction. I believe what we're dealing with is not a gorilla or an ape like most people think, but I've come to the point where I believe that they are an ancient relic hominid that has just been able to survive through several ice ages. They're very robust. They're survivors. And but here we are getting further and further encroaching into some of their natural habitat. So in 2015, I established a nonprofit research organization called the American Primate Conservancy. And our mission statement is the discovery, research, knowledge, recognition, and protection of this species. And, so it has to happen in that order. And right now we've discovered them. They continually seem to be discovered, boy, in my circles, you'd think on maybe a weekly basis. And that's just the ones I hear of. Research is happening. Knowledge is being gained. We've got quite a full database on thousands of sightings. It's the next point, which is the recognition, which is critical in getting any sort of protections afforded these things. And that's the tough nut to crack at this point, but we're working on that. One of the projects I've been working on, because I know there have been efforts by others to get in touch with, for instance, in the United States, the Department of the Interior, who are in charge of the Forest Service and Fish and Wildlife and whatnot, as well as the Canadian counterpart, and those efforts have fallen flat on their face in trying to get them recognized and protected. So I've kind of taken a different route. I've been dealing with Native American tribes. These tribes who have lived symbiotically for tens of thousands of years with these things compared to what are 300 years as far as Europeans or Westerners.
Mm-hmm.
Have. So there's no doubt in their minds, and it's when you start doing research in Native American history, you'd think they were talking about, you know, a coyote. It's just that natural for them. It's no big deal. Well, no pun intended, but they refer to them as the old ones or the first ones. And they wouldn't say that about a bear or a cougar or an elk. You know, they're talking about a tribe. And so what I've been doing is I've drawn up a draft, Protection Act. That's it's a template that you can plug and play different tribes and the different names they call them, whether it's Bigfoot or Oma or Satanga. There's hundreds of different names for these things. But it basically puts some teeth, at least in so much as their reservations are concerned, because they have authority. I mean, they're considered a nation within our nation. And so they can call their own laws. And I think it's going to be a little easier sell for them. And not only does it afford protections for these things, but it also bolsters their culture and their history. And so I've been working with five tribes currently. I've got a Canadian counterpart that's joined me in this effort to start talking with Canadian tribes. But I think, you know, when you start counting up reservations across North America, and there are thousands, that if we can get them on board, it's going to be a much easier sell to then go to, the Department of the Interior or someone else. And it's like, okay, you don't believe in it, but hey, you're surrounded by reservations that all are telling you that you're wrong, you know. So that's just one thing that the Conservancy is working on.
Wow. Yeah, if there's anything we could do, just let us know. And I know Kenny has a few questions for you, but I was wondering, I always wanted to tell my Bigfoot story to a famous researcher, and I want to know your opinion on it, if you wouldn't mind listening.
Well, I wondered how you got involved. Well, I'm very interested.
Okay, well, go on. I remember when we were talking on the phone, you said you lived near Mount Hood, correct?
Yes, I'm actually just at in the foothills, sir.
Okay. Well, I was probably about, 15 years old, and my grandparents would take us to Mount Hood every year, and we'd have a fishing hole and, you know, a regular campsite. So that year we had like three or four friends of the family and family bring their campers. We had a, you know, decent amount of people. As soon as we got to the campsite, me and my cousin Jamal, we were all into Bigfoot and read books. And as soon as we got there, the park ranger said, well, there was a sighting of Bigfoot. And we were all kind of amazed. Really? Really? So every night, we'd go around and, you know, say ghost stories and stuff around the campfire. And that first night, and, you know, sometimes we'd have the adults shake the bush and say it's Bigfoot. So that night, my Aunt Terry comes running, yelling my name. I don't know why she was calling my name, but she fell a couple times. She said, I seen Bigfoot. And then everyone just stopped. And we knew something was weird because the grown-up said, everyone, go ahead. Let's go back, go in our campers, you know, call it a night. So the very next day, well, that same day before we did the Bigfoot stories, me and my cousin walked across a log and went across the river, and we seen these structures by the trees, and they were like rocks and in a circle, and then like sticks put together kind of like in a teepee. And I remember we're walking, and me and him looked up, and we could have sworn we seen something jump behind a tree, like they were watching us. We turn around and we ran back to the, you know, campsite, you know, and we're kind of spooked. But anyways, that night, going back to the night of the campfire, my aunt comes running, crying, you know, we all went in, call it the night. So the next day, me, my cousin Jamal, my sister Jamila, and cousins and siblings, you know, in order, oldest to youngest, we went walking, and we're collecting wood for the campfire for the, you know, the night, that next night. And I heard something, and through the bush, it was a tall thing, and it could have been, I was young at the time, but it was between 7 to 8 feet tall. He's walking towards me, and he was taking his hands, moving the brush from away from his face, but I didn't see his eyes because his face was looking down. And as he got closer and closer, and he got it probably about less than 6 feet, probably 5 feet away from me. And I remember just looking up, and I froze, and he had kind of reddish brown hair. And as he was coming closer, I threw my wood up and said, oh, hell. And my cousin Jamal and sister Jamila saw it, And we took off running to the campsite, and then the rest of the kids followed us. So that was my encounter with Bigfoot. And to this day, I still remember it like it was yesterday. What's that?
How close was it?
I would say about 5 feet away from me.
Wow.
5 to 6 feet away from me. I was really close. And then we thought maybe someone was playing a prank at first, so we called. We had one, all the grown-ups were in the campsite, you know, and we had one of the friends of the family come with us, and we walked back to where we were, and we didn't really see nothing. We saw like maybe where, you know how sometimes when you see like deer or animals, they leave an impression in the bushes and leave it's matted down. We seen a place like that mm-hmm. there, but that was about it. But yeah, I still remember this as like it was yesterday. So, yeah, that was my encounter. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting, and I think part of the reason this individual felt comfortable approaching you was that your age, I mean, being a child at the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're very, very curious about humans, and frankly, 90% of the sightings out there are not people walking up on Bigfoot or tracking Bigfoot down. It's usually people realizing that they're being watched or observed. And generally speaking, when they realize that they've been compromised, that they've been seen, they will turn and walk off. They don't like being observed so much as they like to observe us.
Uh-huh.
So it's fairly rare for them to approach humans. But again, I think that the fact that he didn't really present as much of a threat as, say, a full-grown adult might, it just wanted to check you out. That's a very cool sighting.
Yeah, so what's the chances? I'm sure he probably knew we were there, but what's the chances he was walking and he bumped into us accidentally? That's probably highly unlikely, right? He probably was more curious than anything.
No, yeah, you're dealing with a very primitive wilderness animal. I can assume that they know we're there long before we
right.
even are aware of it ourselves. I'm sure their sense of smell and hearing is quite acute. And let's face it, humans are really some of the smelliest creatures in the forest. But it's rare. It's rare that they approach humans at all. I will say, I had an amazing encounter in October of 2020, where I was invited by a native friend of mine to come out to the Omaha Indian Reservation in Nebraska. And he had been successfully and repeatedly having encounters with these things at night. I wasn't sure what to make of it because you don't hear about that kind of repeated activity. It's usually a one-and-done thing, but he had essentially established a relationship over about 3 years. And it seemed obvious that they were not only aware of him, but they knew him personally. And so I flew out there, and what I saw kind of flies in the face of you know, what I was talking about them trying to stay hidden, because this is hard for me to wrap my head around, and it's one of the projects I'm working on. I have heard throughout my 20, almost 29 years of researching, you'll occasionally hear people talk about this eye shine. Is what they would, it's commonly referred to. People say that they will, that their eyes glow at night. Well, first thing I do when I hear stuff like that, I'm very skeptical. I look for any similar traits in nature. Do any other mammals have the ability to put off some light? And if so, why? And so I kind of put that one in the paranormal file. And, well, I kind of got my butt handed to me when I went over there, because for 5 nights consistently and in 2 different locations on the reservation, we would go out from about midnight till 2:30 in the morning every night, Monday through Friday. And what I saw was exactly what people have been talking about. And they didn't turn and walk away. In fact, in some cases, they approached us. And it just blew my mind. And I've been, again, like I say, trying to wrap my head around how that happens. And I think I've come across some pretty solid scientific reasons and some other examples in nature where that has, it does happen. But it was a, it was just fascinating. My host would go out, take me to this area, very remote, along the Missouri River, and very thick rolling hills with very, very thick hardwoods, maple and oak and such, and darker than dark. I mean, you couldn't see the hand in front of your face, kind of dark. And my friend, he'd step over to this, looking out in the woods in this one particular place that he's frequented, and he would talk in his native language and say, "Oho, Kage," which means hello, friend. And he'd call out to them, mostly speaking English, but he would use a lot of native language as well when he was addressing them. And then suddenly, there's a couple of eyes glowing in the dark. And I'm like, no way. And then you could see them blink. You could see them move. They were brighter when they stared directly at you, and I mean really bright. When they turned their eyes left or right, they would dim out a little bit, you know, if they were looking off to the side. And sometimes there would be 2 and even 3.
They ever throw anything at you?
Excuse me. Not me. I've heard of them doing that, even at this location. But there was also some amazing vocalizations that they were putting out that was just fascinating. Very, very, a variety of sounds that just, for instance, this first one I heard sounded, I assume as a female, very loud, but high-pitched, very high-pitched compared to other vocalizations I've heard. And for the sake of argument, she sang to us almost. It was amazing. She would give this 5 or 6 second long, I don't know, verse, if you will, that changed in volume and pitch and tone and rhythm. And then stop for 10 seconds and then do it all over again. Exactly, repeating exactly the same tune she had done, you know, 10 seconds earlier. And she did this 4 times in a row within a minute.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, it was actually beautiful. I wish I had recorded it. It was not threatening whatsoever. It was kind of welcoming.
So they were on tune, huh?
And,
they were in tune?
it was just this one. Mm-hmm. And I would end up hearing her again in broad daylight, same location, 3 days later, where she did that same ditty, you know, but only once. But I have to tell you, with any time an animal makes a certain sound consistently and repeats it, there's meaning there. Okay, this is arbitrary, random, you know, roaring or screaming or what have you. When they repeat something, you better listen because there's a meaning behind it, you know. Later on, we had my native friend is very religious, and I think it was 3 days into it. We're out there again in the middle of the night, well, technically morning, and we weren't getting a lot of activity, so he goes, you know, I'm going to try something. I've only done this a couple times, but sometimes it works. Sometimes it gets their attention. So he's like, Aho Kage, I want to pray to the Creator to ask him to protect you and your family and for your happiness. And if you want to, you know, come forward and you can pray with me. And I'm like, okay, here we go. So he bows his head, as did I, and he starts this prayer, and it's all in English. It's about a 3 minute long prayer he did. And about halfway through it, about 90 seconds into it, we got treated to this, very close, probably, you know, 60 feet away, this high pitch. It does this four times, a lot louder than that. And it was like 60 feet away, right in the middle of the prayer, you know, and it was all I could do not to look up. And anyway, so Barry finishes his prayer. I look and says, that one prayer? He's like, yep. He goes, sometimes, I told you, sometimes it works. And then there was another location we went to, maybe four and a half miles from there. He said, sometimes we get activity here too. And it was, again, very, very early in the morning. And we get there, we shut off all the lights. And this is very remote now. I took my two-wheel drive rental car places I shouldn't have. We'll just put it that. And we get in there, shut off all the lights again, pitch black. Can't see the hand in front of your face. My friend calls out into the woods, and sure enough, straight down the road in the direction the car was pointing, a set of eyes. And I would estimate 100 and maybe 120 feet away. And I'm like, wow, here we are 4.5 miles away. And we'd just come from the other site and we had activity there as well. And then we catch one at about our 3 o'clock trying to work its way behind us. And, you know, this is, like I said, this has been going on pretty consistently. And I'm very excited about what I'm seeing, and I'm getting a little frustrated knowing that I've got to leave in a couple of days, and I just wanted to, you know, up the game a little bit. So I turn to my friend, I go, have you ever thought about just walking up to them? And he looked at me, no, that's crazy. And I'm like, hold my beer. He's like, what? I'm like, you got to stay here. Don't follow me. And I just started walking down that road, and I can't even see the road. But I know just if I walk towards those eyes, then I'll be on the road. And it was pretty freaky. I got about, I want to say about 40 or 50 feet away when this thing finally turned and walked off. But, yeah, he still talked about that crazy white man. But I just wanted to take it up a notch, and I was feeling pretty comfortable with them. Because they obviously were fascinated by us enough to make an appearance and whatnot. So I'm like, why not? You know, what's the worst going to happen? Rip me limb from limb, but, you know.
Wow. Hey, Kenny,
anyway,
Well, that's awesome. That's a great story.
Do you have a couple of questions?
Yeah, quite an experience you had. I was just going to ask him, you know, what was your, some of your favorite expeditions and, you know, how far have you gone? You know, have you stuck to, you know, besides going to Nebraska, you know, do you stick to mostly the Northwest or what's the farthest, what are your, where have your travels taken you?
Well,
have you gone up to Alaska or out of the country? Or?
Yeah. Mainly the West Coast. I have done some research in Ohio, Nebraska, and more recently, just this last spring, in Oklahoma. But yeah, California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska. Did an investigation there a couple years ago of a sighting.
Have you ever felt in danger when you've been out, besides other wild animals out there? Have you, you know, felt uneasy, you know, when you're
one time specifically that I'll never forget. I had organized an expedition, an 8-day long expedition at the base of Saddle Mountain, in fact. And again, we needed to use these master keys to get in there. Uh-huh. And I was fortunate enough to have both Ron Moorhead and Peter Byrne along as part of my team. I'm sure some of your listeners know who they are. We established our base camp in this kind of elk meadow at the base of the mountain. And Ron is a pilot and owns his own plane. And so he decided to fly into Seaside in the Cessna Bushmaster. And we had hoped to be able to use it for aerial reconnaissance, but the weather was just horrific. Rain on the verge of snow, and we had hail and sleet. It wasn't conducive to flying in. And I think it was on day 6 that Ron said, "Hey guys, I hate to say this, but we got a break in the weather. And I, even though I'm instrument rated, I'd prefer to fly up visually. So if one of you can give me a ride down to the airport, I'd appreciate it." And so Peter took Ron, leaving me up at the base camp by myself. And I had this kit of seismic ground sensors that was on loan to me from the North American Science Institute. These sensors are incredibly sensitive, and they'll pick up vibrations in the ground. And you couldn't walk within 50 feet of them without setting them off. But when I say setting them off, it just sends a silent signal back to a receiver at the base camp. And I thought, you know what? Well, they're gone. This would be a perfect time to increase these seismic sensors. So I hiked up above the base camp into some reprod and started calibrating these to figure out what their range was. And I was just going to do a picket line across above the camp so nothing could really come down from the mountain without us detecting it. I got about, I don't know, 2 of them in the ground when a hailstorm was approaching, and I realized I probably couldn't have got down to the base camp, so I thought I'll take shelter about 100 yards up the mountain, because this is all old growth, never cut timber. Huge Douglas firs, over 200 feet high kind of thing. So I thought, I'll just get under these trees and let the trees act as an umbrella for me. This hailstorm should pass pretty quickly, and then I'll get back to what I was doing. So I got up there, and I had to urinate. You know, that was a perfect place. I'm not going to get hit with hail. So I did my business. I'm wearing BDU's battle dress uniform, trousers, you know, camouflage. And I buttoned up my fly, and I'm feeling fine. I'm just waiting for this storm to pass by, and start buckling my belt. When all of a sudden, from about my 10 o'clock in the direction I was facing, I was greeted with an incredible roar that was ear splitting and in no way could be associated with any known animal. This thing went on for about 3 seconds or so, and it was coming from behind this hedge about 70 feet away. And here I am, all by myself, no weapons. Left those all in the, I left those all at base camp like an idiot. I'm telling you, I've done some crazy stuff in my life. I've swam with sharks. I've more recently, I got chased by a grizzly up in British Columbia. I've summited mountains. I've jumped out of perfectly good working airplanes. I've been shot at with missiles, rockets, mortars. I have never, ever, reached that level of fear in my life that I did that day. I was basically paralyzed with fear. I could not move. For two minutes, my hands just rested on my belt buckle, and I don't think I even blinked. My body felt like it was, and I'm sure it was just adrenaline, but my body was just buzzing, you know, like I drank a couple pots of coffee. I was just, it was the most. You know, I described it to a friend of mine. I said, who had a similar experience in Washington State, and I said I've never felt so helpless in my life. And he turned to me and he goes, "No, more like hopeless." And I'm like, you know what? That's a much better adjective. I had no hope. I knew whatever made that sound could have its way with me, and I wouldn't stand a chance. Anyway, after about 2 minutes, I think I finally blinked, and I'm just moving my eyes. I'm not even moving my body or my head. I'm just looking around for anything to try to defend myself with, which was pretty fruitless. And I just backed down that hill and waited for Peter to come back before I went back up there. It's a hell of a feeling to have no hope at all. Wow. And I've had that experience. No, you can't. In fact, I tell people probably the closest analogy to what I experienced was imagine being pushed out of an airplane at 20,000 feet without a parachute. Now, you know, talk about hopeless. And you know how this movie is going to end, and there's nothing you can do about it but wait. And you know, that's how terrified I was. I assumed that this was not going to end well, and I had absolutely no control over the situation.
Wow. Well, Mr. Neese, before we get to our emails, would you mind telling us about Beachfoot?
Oh, I'd love to. Beachfoot is unlike any of the Bigfoot conferences around. It's a very unique gathering. In 2008, I had reflected on all these people, researchers, famous people that I had been fortunate enough to meet and in some cases become friends. You know, believe it or not, there is some rivalry in the Bigfoot world and in the Bigfoot community. And some of it might be jealousy, some of it might be competition. I don't know, but you know, I've met all these people, and I thought, man, what would it be like if they could just put that aside? And what would it be like to get them all in the same room at the same time? It, just what a huge volume of research all in one place and so much knowledge. And then I just kind of tweaked it a little bit, and I go, I know what would be better is to get these researchers and researchers only around a bonfire with a beer in their hand for 3 or 4 days and let them get to really know each other. And that's what we did. It was 2008 was the first one we ever did. This year will mark our 15th year. And it's just taken on a life of its own. And so when I say it's unique, number one, it's private invitation only. It's not open to the public. We limited it to 100 researchers, and it's serious researchers. And we've had them come from all over the world, in Australia, England, Russia, New Zealand, and all across the U.S. and Canada. So imagine these people come in at their own expense, by the way, and get together for 4 days and 3 nights in a campground setting. Most of the people tented, probably 20% of them bring RVs, but we've got this private 10-acre park along the Alsea River that we've kind of settled on. We used to move it around every year, but now people really like this location. And so they get together and I arrange for 5 or 6 of them to every year to address their own constituents, basically. And some amazing things have happened. I mean, we've had basically everybody who's anybody in the Bigfoot field has been there at one time or another, and a lot of them are repeat guests. And we've had engagements happen there. Surprised we haven't any births there. In fact, my wife and I got married there in a surprise wedding in 2014. Nobody knew we were going to do it. Found out one of my speakers, Professor Rettman Mullis, also happened to be an ordained minister. And so we kind of got together beforehand. And I turned to my wife and go, you know, I'd like to get married at the beachfront. And it was a lot of fun. I think a lot of people thought we were doing a skit. we just put it on the schedule as a special event at 6:30. And so everybody kind of gathered in this covered pavilion area, and we only had a half hour to knock the whole thing out because at 7 o'clock, Les Stroud, survivor name you might know him as, was going to address the audience. We knocked it out in about 10 minutes and had some hugs and pictures and had to get back in to listen to Les.
Sweet.
But Facebook is just, if you go to my Facebook, I have a specific Facebook page dedicated to Bigfoot. And if you just look through the picture gallery, it's pretty cool. The people that have came to this event. Also, if you want to really get a flavor for it, a friend of mine put together a documentary. It's on YouTube. It's a Bigfoot 10th anniversary special. It's about 35, 40 minutes long, and he did a wonderful job really capturing the event. And it's funny. You'll laugh. You'll probably cry at certain times. But it's well done. And yeah, that's Bigfoot. And I could get hit by a bus. I can get hit by a bus tomorrow, and I guarantee you Bigfoot will just go on.
Nice.
Anyway, it's a lot of fun, and I would say extremely, very unique. No vendors, no public, just researchers.
Kenny, you got any more questions before I hit the emails?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I was just going to say it'd be awesome to be a fly on the wall or a squirrel in the tree to listen to everybody comparing notes and, you know, the conversations that are being had during that.
Yes. Shoot me your email address. Maybe I can sneak you in.
Ooh, that's awesome. Hey, we got it on recorded now. We got records of it.
You've got mail.
Okay. Well, we got a hand.
We like to have faces.
Awesome. Awesome. You'll have one beautiful face and one so-so face.
We haven't had a wrestling match break out in Facebook yet. So.
Okay. Well, we got a handful of emails for you, Mr. Neese, if you'd like to answer them.
Sure.
Okay. Did you like my little AOL?
You've got mail.
Sound effects?
Not as good as mine.
I'm usually sound effect happy, but I toned down because you're on here today. So, anyways.
Fair enough.
Okay, our first email is from Jose Walker, longtime listener, and he sent his email to murkychronicles@gmail.com, and he writes, on an earlier episode of Murky Chronicles, you played a clip about the Mount St. Helens Bigfoot cover-up right after the eruption of May 18th, 1980. I found the documentary fascinating. Mr. Neese, you know anything about that?
Well, I've certainly heard about it from a number of different sources, all really third-party sources. So I've never spoke with anybody directly involved in what was allegedly a number of dead big feet that were discovered in the wake of the eruption and secretly carted off by helicopters with cargo nets dangling beneath them and arms and legs sticking through the net. I really am not a conspiratorialist. And when people say, oh, the government knows about them, government's trying to hide them, you have to ask why. And more to the point, when Bigfoot is, when a body comes in, some remains or what have you come in, or, you know, if they're discovered, unless there's a government agent hiding behind every tree, there's nothing stopping an individual from going directly to the media or, you know, so knowing that, if I were the government, it makes no sense to try to contain any information on these. I mean, if this were the case, would not we be talking about this in the same way in the late 1800s when they discovered the lowland gorilla, or in the 1920s when they discovered the mountain gorilla? Nothing happened. Okay. It's not the end of the world. And I'd be honest with you, when you look at the global distribution of primates, you'll find them all around in the tropical zone, the equatorial zone. You'll find them in the southern hemisphere of both east and western hemispheres. In the eastern hemisphere, in the temperate range there, we've got monkeys that live in the snow in Japan. What's really glaring is the absence of any primate activity. And let's keep in mind, humans, by definition, are primates. This is what I'm talking about. But the point is, why don't we have something like this? It shouldn't be a big surprise. It shouldn't be a shock. We have plenty. I'm just looking out my window here. There could be something standing 100 feet away. I couldn't see it. You know, it's very remote. There's plenty of habitat, and there's plenty of food resources that would support such a thing. So, again, getting back to the government purposely trying to suppress any information about this, and going to lengths of rounding up as many carcasses as they can, and who's to say they got them all? You know, it's just to me, it seems ludicrous. And so...
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. What did you gonna say?
Well, I just say I don't put a lot of credence in that story.
Okay.
I just don't. It doesn't. I can't see. You know, in reality, there's nothing government can do to prevent somebody from bringing out a body. They're not behind every rock
Right.
Behind every tree and under every rock. Can't be everywhere at once. When it happens, and I think it's inevitable it will, it's just going to happen. It's going to be, yeah, everybody's going to go, wow, you know. But
well, my question is, so, you know, they say, you know, there's coyotes in every city in the United States. That being said, has there ever been a sighting of a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch actually roaming the town or, you know, in a city?
There have been a lot of suburban sightings, for instance. Obviously, rural sightings. Urban sightings, not so much. I'm sure it's happened before. But those, you know, I think this species is very opportunist when it comes to food. Much like a black bear, if you would, that they're, I think they have a very similar diet, as a black bear, herbivorous and as well as, carnivorous. And God knows black bears love to forage in the city dump,
right.
In dumpsters, you know, whatever is easiest. So they're, I think they would take the opportunity to encroach in our direction, which they do. I mean, they've been known to actually steal food, right off of picnic tables. In one case, I remember back in the 60s, right out of a refrigerator.
Wow.
That happened to be outdoors. Interesting. Carted off a bunch of meat. So is it impossible? No, it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare. But even where I live, which is fairly rural, there are sightings all over the place, within 10 miles of me. I can probably think of at least a half a dozen. So we're basically in the Mountain National Forest, and that's one of a couple primary research areas that we cover. But they've been seen going through people's backyards, on the Warm Springs Reservation, for instance. Got a call from a gal that said that things cruising through the neighborhood and climbing over fences and going through people's yards. I think as time goes on, it's obviously depending on the individuals, they do establish relationships and they do get more and more comfortable dealing with humans. Not a lot of city sightings, I'm afraid.
All right, we have another email. This one's from longtime listener Jelly Jelly. Send her email to murkychronicles@gmail.com. There are folklore that Sasquatch raped Native American women and had offspring. Is there any evidence or any truth to that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I would say most recently, and you can look this up. There was a situation, I want to say it goes back, early 20th century, where the Colville Indian tribe, which is in Washington, kind of north central Washington, they would annually, when salmon runs came into this particular river, and I was just up there, it's called the Sand Pool River that goes into the Columbia, through the reservation. When the salmon came in there, they would set up a temporary camp, where the fishing hole was outside of their normal village. And they would spend a good, you know, 3-4 weeks, however long the salmon ran, living there, and the men would go out and catch fish, and the women would prepare the fish, clean them, skin them, and put them on drying racks, and smoke them. And there was this one particular day
this one young lady went down to a nearby to get some water, and they heard her scream, and they all came running, and by the time they got to where she was, they observed this Bigfoot carrying her off into the mountains. And they didn't dare try to intervene at this point, and she was smart enough to tear pieces of her skirt, which is, she was wearing some kind of white skirt, and she would drop pieces of her skirt to leave a trail for them to try to find her. And several weeks had gone by, and salmon run had stopped, and they were packing up, and they thought, just before we go back to the main village, let's go out and search for her. And they followed this trail of cloth. And they got up to this meadow. They were on horseback. They got up to this meadow, and here she was on her hands and knees digging tubers or roots and putting them in her dress. And nearby, allegedly, this Sasquatch was sneaking while she was gathering these roots. And she saw them, and they signaled her to come to them, and she quietly crawled over and was able to get on the back of one of the horses without waking the Sasquatch, and they got out of there. And she would go on to say that she lived in a cave for several weeks with this being, and they would store these tubers in the cave. It was their main diet for the most part, and lo and behold, she was pregnant. And she went on to have a son. His name was Patrick. He lived on the reservation. And he was very odd, obviously being a hybrid. He was not very tall, but he was extremely muscular. They described him, they called him a pinhead. And I think what they're referring to is he had somewhat of a conical-shaped head, similar to the Bigfoot. And very, very strong. And actually very intelligent. They actually put him through school. He got good grades, went on to be a rancher on the reservation. He was, like I said, he was different, right? I want to say, I think he went on to father some children as well. But the story's out there. You can look it up. I Google it. But that's one of many, many stories of them kidnapping women or children for the most part. There's, a couple stories going back to 1924 with the Albert Otzman story in British Columbia, where he was literally kidnapped in his sleeping bag by a Bigfoot who carried him several miles and spent the better part of a week with this Bigfoot family before he was able to escape. So, I mean, there's stories out there that for the most part, yeah, for women and children, the legends up in British Columbia of Bequas and Bessonnequah. Bessonnequah was known to, at least by their tribal culture, to carry a large basket on her back and put kids in there. Chase up his way.
Wow.
I've seen drawings of that. Who knows? But I think every story out there, every tale, every tradition has some truth in its origins.
Okay.
So it might get exaggerated a little bit, but this story out of the tribe up there is very well documented. It would be interesting if they were ever allowed to exhume Patrick's grave and do some DNA testing on it, but I doubt that's ever going to happen.
Right. Okay, we got one more email from Robert Long.
Okay.
And he sent his email to murkychronicles@gmail.com. Mr. Neese, there are people that are saying maybe there may be evidence of interdimensional connection between Bigfoot and UFOs. Also, some say Bigfoots travel through portals. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, interesting you bring that up. So when people ask me if I think they're extraterrestrial, my answer to them is, you know, there is no species on this planet that is more terrestrial than these. Not extraterrestrial, terrestrial, but probably one of the longest lived species, extremely survival, if it comes down to, the same nature of survival of the fittest, these are about the fittest damn things out there. And I think they go back tens of thousands of years. I don't think there is any connection to any sort of extraterrestrial activity. Now, as far as them disappearing and reappearing at will and portals and interdimensional stuff, I'm actually working on an experiment to try to make sense scientifically of what people are experiencing. And one of the things I'm doing is I'm experimenting with fiber optics. There is, in fact, examples in nature of what I'm about to explain to you, specifically the polar bear. If I were to ask you what color a polar bear is, what would you say? What color is polar bear's fur?
They're white, but ain't their skin black?
Yeah.
Their skin is black, and their outer coat of their fur consists of guard hairs, which are completely devoid of pigment. They're translucent. And a lot of animals have guard hairs. They just kind of, you have a base coat, and then you've got an outer coat. Now, in the case of the polar bear, you're looking at what these clear shafts do is they, like fiber optics, and I've bought 1,000 feet of fiber optics that I'm looking at right now. They transmit, they collect and transmit the ambient light and color around the animal. And then they also collect heat and are able to transfer that heat down into the base coat of the fur. But the light hitting this, the light that hits these clear shafts of hair, subsequently scatter in all directions, and they even transmit back and forth to each other that light and underneath that base coat amongst themselves. And this is known to happen. And so I had observed a couple different hair samples that were alleged to be Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And these samples were magnified under microscope, so backlit with white light, right? And these weren't individual hairs, but rather a clump of hair, if you will. And lo and behold, there were these clear shafts intermixed with darker shafts, but so clear that if you look, you could literally see the darker shafts through those clear shafts. What if Bigfoot has a similar characteristic? What if they have clear hairs, clear shafts of hair that extend as guard hairs beyond their normal hair?
It would kind of make them invisible, right? Or
well, so my theory, if I prove it to be true, is going to be that it can create really the ultimate camouflage. And by way of experiment, I'm attempting to obtain a pretty good sized swatch of black bear fur. And I plan to put it on a stretch board or whatever and place it in different settings in the forest, different positions and different lighting conditions as is. And then afterward, I plan to start inserting or cutting lengths of this fiber optics I have. That's very clear fiber optics through the backside of the hide, and adding these extended guard hairs, if you will, in the form of fiber optics, and take it right back to the very locations under the same lighting conditions and just see if that fiber optic or hollow clear hair shafts that I've simulated don't give this fur a unique camouflage ability. And so it's kind of like the eyeshine thing. I always wrote that off as paranormal or what have you, the woo factor. And like I said, I got my ass in for me when I saw what I saw. So I'm trying to find a scientific way to explain what I saw and what I didn't believe people were seeing, but I experienced it myself. Same thing with this. If my experiment turns out the way I hope it will, if the creature's standing still, and they're very good at doing that, it would be difficult as hell to see them. Now, if they move, that's going to be a bit of a different story, or if they're in the shade where they wouldn't necessarily have the light hitting directly on these guard hairs. But anyway, it's a fun experiment. I'm looking forward to doing it just to see if it pans out.
That would be a great discovery.
Just a way to explain, hey, no, you didn't see this thing vanish or appear out of nowhere or go through a portal or become transdimensional. It has, here's a scientific reason what might explain why they seem to disappear or reappear. You know, kind of like the old movie Predator, you know, when that thing stood still, you can hardly see it. And when it
moves,
you can see this kind of wave of background light. Yeah. I think there's something to that. So I'll keep you posted.
That would be awesome. You have any more questions, Kenny?
No, but that totally makes sense what you're saying, because I mean, there's plenty of animals that do blend in, you know, like even insects that blend in, like they look like a leaf or something, you know, they're definitely camouflaged to where around for their setting. So,
you look at the octopus, how it can really match the background color, or a chameleon, or anything else. Nature's giving certain animals some pretty amazing qualities.
No, I think that's great. You know, that'd be great research. Hopefully you find what you're looking for on that.
Way of trying to explain the woo factor and try to make more sense.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of running. We're kind of running down on time here. So if you have any shout outs or plugs and anything you want the great listeners to know about, it's your form.
Oh, thank you. I mean, we do have the Conservancy does have a website. It's it can be found at AmericanPrimate.org, O-R-G. Constantly constructing on that. I also have an American Primate Conservancy Facebook page, as well as my own personal page, so they can feel free to reach out to me there if you'd like. Even if somebody wants to email me, that's fine as well. My email address is AmericanPrimate@AOL.com. Yeah, there's still a couple of us still using that. I've got a pretty extensive speaking schedule ahead of me this year. I'll be speaking in Oregon, not too far from here, in March, and then in April I'll be in Nebraska, Hastings, Nebraska, then Coshocton, let's see, that's April. May, I'll be in Coshocton, Ohio. And then in June, after Beachfoot, I'll be traveling to Virginia to speak there. And so hopefully, if your listeners are out in that area, feel free to come on by and introduce yourselves. That'd be great.
Oh, we definitely will probably make Kenny and I, gorgeous Kenny Roberts and I, might you make a road trip and come check you out. And what's the chances one day? We always talked about maybe going on a Bigfoot expedition. What's the chances that, is there any of them around, or do you ever do any expeditions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not far from here, there's a wilderness area on the west side of Mount Hood, and really 15, 20 minute drive from my house. So where there's been some current activity last summer, there was some, a place called Bradley Horse Camp where, as the name says, a camp was set up for horseback riders. It's got stables and stalls and whatnot, and people ride all these trails, and met this one couple that had a lot of activity. We spent about 5 days up there putting out cameras, using drones to do some aerial photography. And, but they were having some fairly consistent encounters, the year before, and they even said they had some things happening, you know, rocks being thrown in their direction while they were horseback riding. Large scale expeditions, I'd say, you know, of over a week in duration, I love doing them. In 2016, we did a major expedition off the coast of British Columbia, taking a 50-foot trawler out of Campbell River and exploring the Broughton Archipelago, which is all these forested, uninhabited islands that number in the dozens. And anchoring off offshore and taking a couple of Zodiacs ashore. We had a film crew with us, and that was pretty interesting. It was called Operation Sea Monkey. I know that's corny, but it seemed to fit, you know. I didn't recall any Bigfoot researchers approaching Bigfoot research from the sea. And we found out that the islands are not necessarily inhabited. There's a hell of a lot of wildlife out there. And where there were people, you'll find some abandoned Indian villages and whatnot. But, yeah, that's where we got chased by a grizzly bear. And that's a story for another day. But, I'm looking forward to setting up some more expeditions, and I'll keep you all in mind.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, anything else, guys?
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Love to have you on again, because I'm sure we could talk a lot more on your experiences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd enjoy that, and I've had a good time chatting with you all, and thanks for having me.
All right, thank you all. Until next time, hashtag save our children. Epstein and McAfee didn't kill themselves, and if she has an apple, she has a banana.
Happy. I got a happy ending today.
Woo!
Yowie!
Zoinks! This is Theyfula, the Butcher Dobashi. Please share, follow, and/or subscribe on iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on most of your major podcast platforms. I am also ordained, and I can marry you and give you all your blessing needs. Send your booking request to DobashiBookings@gmail.com. For all the links, go to LyricalSpit.com.
help keep this show free? By buying some of our swag of apparel at butcherspit.com. We have t-shirts, hoodies, and even baby onesies. That's butcherspit.com.
Be sure to check out Murky Chronicles, drops every Friday, hosted by yours truly, Theyfella, the Butcher Dobashi, and Kenny Roberts. With guests, stories, news on unexplained and bizarre happenings, you can listen on your favorite podcast platforms or just go to lyricalspit.com for the latest shows and links.